Welcome to the Unconquered Podcast.
At Florida State, we won national championships and ACC championships.
That's some basics, consistency in what we're doing. Guys get real banged and we work in a bunch of different situations, making progress.
You have to have success, so you know something like that.
Welcome back to the Unconquered Podcast, everybody. I'm your host, Jason Staples, here on Seminole Sports Radio. Once again, this podcast is brought to you by Louis Marquez of Keller Williams Realty in Jacksonville. Louis continues to be a trained photographer and videographer and will make sure that you get the most successful online marketing plan with the best possible photos and video to showcase your home and sell it quickly for the best possible price. If you have any real estate needs in the greater Jacksonville area, get in touch with Louis at 850-443-5797 or email him at Louis Marquez, L-U-I-S Marquez, at kw.com. Let him know you heard about him from through the podcast. He'll help us out quite a bit. All right. Well, this is the Miami preview. And lots of people out there talking about how Florida State season is over, and this is the beginning of the end for Jimbo Fisher, the beginning of a new lost decade for Florida State. And oh my goodness. Jeez. Well, before we get to Miami, one thing we should talk about is Justin Fields. Things have gone sideways, obviously, in the Justin Fields recruitment. Word is that he will be committing Friday morning when this podcast, around the time this podcast releases, and doing so without an official visit to Florida State after having lots of visits to Georgia in the time period since the last time he visited Florida State. Follow the visits, and the kid's going to Georgia. Most likely, he's going to Georgia. Georgia has done a really good job winning the kid's eye. And here's the thing that has really struck me about this is, who would have thought that Florida State's opening schedule and how things more or less transpired, but Florida State's opening schedule would have been the primary, the biggest factor in making sure that Justin Field didn't wind up at Florida State and wound up in Athens. It's remarkable. Now, some of you out there are going to go, no, it's not schedule. It's an old coaching staff, or it's how they played. Well, listen, Florida State right now, the biggest thing I think that has affected Fields' decision is the perception of Florida State's program right now. And particularly, Georgia has capitalized on the perception that if Fields goes to Florida State, he's going to get beat up, and you know he'll wind up hurt like DeAndre Francois, and that he'd be better off staying home and winding up at Georgia. And some of the fans out there, of course, have been spreading this Florida State's offensive line gets their quarterbacks beat up way more than anybody else narrative, which is simply not true. And of course, some of you guys will go, well, look at the tape that somebody put together. I mean, you can see that there's a DeAndre Francois punishment reel on YouTube. And you can go and take a look at all the hits, all the shots that Francois took. Go and look at it. One of the things that you'll find is, first of all, there actually aren't that many hits on the year relative to how many throws he had. He took some big shots. But every quarterback takes some big shots. That's part of the job description. You have to be able to make throws when a guy's bearing down to you, particularly if you're going to make some big play throws. That's part of the job description. Everybody has that. Look at what happened with Lamar Jackson against NC State tonight. Lamar Jackson spent as much time on his back as he did on his feet. And that's a guy with a lot better mobility, a lot better sense in those regards, and a guy that gets rid of the football pretty well at this point, than the two freshman quarterbacks that Florida State's had so far. Quality defensive line, kid that's going to make some big plays, he's going to take some shots. So that's number one. Number two is, go back through and take a look at how much of that punishment tape is, how many of those are uncalled unnecessary roughing or unnecessary roughness, roughing the passer, or targeting calls after the ball's left his hand or in other situations. And think about the difference in optics if those calls are made. If those calls get made, the optics and the perception changes quite a bit. Now, against Clemson on the last drive of the game last year, Florida State's offensive line was awful, and he took a couple really bad shots. He took a bad shot against, this is Francois, he took a bad shot against Ole Miss at the beginning of the year. He took another bad shot against against Michigan. But if you go through the year, most quarterbacks are going to take one or two of those, say, per half of season. It's just going to, it's the way football works. But somehow the narrative got started otherwise. And, you know, Florida State fans have had this, you know, Trickett sucks narrative for a long time, which is, you know, Florida State fans, what are you going to do? In any case, what I'm saying about the schedule is Florida State opened with two of probably the top five defensive lines in the country. Alabama and NC State. Those two top five, maybe top three defensive lines, top four defensive lines. Open with those two games with a 21-day break, and then, of course, breaking in an 18-year-old true freshman without any sort of dress rehearsal as well. Florida State opens with those two programs. Great optics, especially given the narrative that people really tried to push. Because the narrative went from DeAndre Francois is a tough SOB who will hold the football longer than he needs to try to make a play, and he'll be willing to take that punishment, to Florida State's offensive line gets their quarterbacks killed. And then, of course, Francois gets hurt against Alabama, which probably doesn't happen against most teams. He can go ahead and hold the football and make that mistake against a lot of teams and not wind up with a torn patellar tendon. And again, it's I feel terrible for DeAndre that's happened. But, you know, that again, that's on DeAndre. He's responsible for that safety blitzer and that look. But in any case, that narrative gets pushed further and further by playing two of the top five defensive lines and then one of the, I think, three best tackle for loss defensive lines in the country. They're not as talented as some of the others, but in terms of what they've done this year, they've been getting after the quarterback in Wake. So Florida State starts out, and the optics are terrible. And so then you wind up losing a guy like Fields in terms of what things look like on the field. All of that happens while Georgia opens with Appalachian State at Notre Dame, Samford, an overrated Mississippi State team, and a terrible Tennessee team, and dominates. And Georgia's looked great, guys. They've looked great. But the only real quality defense that they've played out of that group, really good defense, is Notre Dame, and Jake Fromm took a beating. And their starting quarterback got hurt against Appalachian State in the opener. So, but anyway, the optics really changed and the narrative is different. So if Florida State had, just a thought experiment, had opened with, say, Bethune-Cookman, Toledo, and at Duke, it'd be a really good chance that Justin Fields is committing to Florida State on Friday. Which, incidentally, it's worth noting that is the schedule that Miami had coming into this game. And the narrative about Miami is, once again, Miami is finally poised to beat Florida State. They're going to beat Florida State. Florida State is down. They're on the canvas, and they're waiting on that eight count, and Miami is there to stomp their face into the canvas. Well, here's the thing, though. Miami's got some weaknesses that have showed up against these other programs, against these other teams, that are nowhere near as good as Florida State. We've seen this movie before. We saw it in 2016. Miami ran the football like gangbusters right up until the Florida State game. And Miami's schedule before Florida State last year, 70-3 against Florida A&M, 38-10 against Florida Atlantic, 45-10 against Appalachian State, 35-21 against Georgia Tech. And everybody said they're going to come in and they're not only going to beat Florida State, they're going to beat them comfortably at home. This is a bad Florida State team. They've got two losses already, and Florida State went down to Miami and beat them. Well, And, you know, you look at what they did against, say, Appalachian State and Florida Atlantic last year, and it was every bit as impressive, if not more so, than anything they did so far this year against, say, Toledo. Georgia Tech last year, right before Florida State, they beat them 35-21, impressive win. They beat Duke 31-6 in an impressive win right before Florida State this year. We've seen this movie before. We can go back to 2015, 2014, this movie's shown. Now, the thing that is true is that every time these have been one score or really close football games, Miami's been in the game. They've been in position to beat Florida State in those games. But this is not a situation where anybody should be coming in and saying, "Yeah, Miami's just a better, way better football team. Florida State really isn't gonna be in this game." Not what I've seen. Again, you have to account for a difference in strength of schedule. And I waited to record this podcast until after the NC State Louisville game for a reason, because I was going to say Florida State's played the toughest schedule in the country. Florida State and Texas have played the two toughest schedules in the country. Florida State, I think, a little bit tougher. But that's especially the case up front, where both Alabama and NC State are a good bit better than Miami. Even Wake Forest, right in the same area as Miami in terms of what they're able to do, in terms of producing pressure and all of that. Now, they do it differently. Miami has more overall talent. Particularly, Miami has more size, but that doesn't necessarily make them harder to block, say, than Wake Forest unit. All you have to do is go back to some of the little bit undersized guys that have come out of the even just the ACC, back with Nikita Whitlock, or right now the best defensive tackle in the NFL out of Pitt, that is Aaron Donald. So, just wanted to start with that, and I wanted to make sure that I wasn't just, seeing things without proper clarity. So I waited until after the Louisville game to say this, because in my view, what I've seen so far is Florida State has played a lot better competition than Miami. I think even Wake Forest is a little better than Duke. And Florida State has played much better competition than the other two, obviously. And so the primary difference in perception boils down, just like with Justin Fields' decision, the primary difference in the perception surrounding the two programs, Florida State and Miami right now, boils down to strength of schedule. Florida State's played a much tougher slate than Miami. And I don't see any reason when I watch Miami to go, "Oh yeah, they're way better than Florida State." I just haven't seen it. Now, as we get into it, I do see a team that can play with Florida State. It's a team that's just like last year, just like the year before, good enough to challenge Florida State, probably keep the game within a score, maybe win the game. But when I see this game, Florida State should be favored in this game. Couple reasons for this. Number one is rush defense and rushing. So last year, coming into the Florida State game, Miami had averaged 10.36 yards per carry against Florida A&M, 7 yards per carry against Florida Atlantic, 5.29 yards per carry against Appalachian State, and 4.22 yards per carry against Georgia Tech. Now, that's decreasing each game, and then 2.21 against Florida State. This year, Miami has averaged, 9 yards per carry against Bethune, 9 yards per carry against Toledo, and 3.97 against Duke. Just like last year, all of a sudden you go from those inflated rushing yards against inferior competition. Last year's 4.22 against Georgia Tech. This year, 3.97 yards per carry against Duke. Now, that is including sack yardage, but I don't really have the time to take that out at the moment. Either way, given the way that Malik Rozier has run the football himself, that sack yardage kind of evens out, so it gives you some good idea. You can maybe add an extra yard in if you want to just talk about rushing totals. The other thing comes down to rush defense. And when you look at Miami's rushing defense, last year, gave up 0.52 yards per carry against Florida A&M, 1.38 yards per carry to Florida Atlantic, 2.94 to Appalachian State, 4.94 to Georgia Tech, and then 3.84 to Florida State. Okay. This year, 4.03 to Bethune, 2.43 to Toledo, 3.98 to Duke. It is looking almost identical. One difference, though, if you look at what Duke did against Miami, those are a little deceptive. And again, the sack yardage is the key here. Duke's running backs averaged 5.8 yards per carry against Miami. Very interesting. Very interesting. Because Florida State has better backs and, yes, a better offensive line. I saw Duke in person 2 weeks ago. Has a better offensive line than Duke, and along with better backs. They gave up 5.8 yards per carry to Duke. Now, given that they are more than likely going to really struggle to run the football against Florida State, based on both Florida State, Florida State against Alabama gave up 4.2 yards per rush. Alabama, the rest of the year, 7.7 yards per rush. Okay? Similar kind of disparity with NC State. NC State ran the football all over Louisville last night. Not against Florida State. So they won't be able to run the football like they've been able to. Very unlikely that they'll be able to do that. They may have a play or two. Walton can fly. Number one. And, you know, they run some read option stuff with the quarterback. But, you know, given some of the RPO stuff that they do, which has nothing, of course, to do really with the quarterback run game so much as him asking him to read the secondary or read a second-level defender while throwing, similar stuff in a lot of ways to what Florida State does in the RPO game, they're going to get their quarterback hit as well. The RPO stuff, you're going to get your quarterback hit if you run RPOs. Just go back and watch the Gruden deal with last year's Miami quarterback, Brad Kaya, and look at the discussion of some of the RPOs against Florida State, and Gruden kind of chuckling about, well, you know, maybe you don't want to run RPOs a whole lot against really, really good defenses because, you know, your quarterback's going to get killed. Well, you know, Miami's going to try it again, I'm sure, with Rozier, but yeah, worth noting. Florida State will do a little bit less of it. They'll do some bubble RPOs, I'm sure, in this game. They did it against Miami last year, but those don't tend not to get your quarterback hit as much. Francois didn't really get hit against Miami last year, except in two occasions where he held the football forever, and then on a three, way after the throw, should have been flagged. One of them was late hits by the Miami defensive line, which was clearly trying to knock him out. So, yeah, that's the way that's going to go. But the big thing to me is rush defense on each side. Florida State has a better rush defense. They just do. And then rush offense. And Florida State will be the best rushing offense that that Miami has played. And they just gave up almost 6 yards per carry to Duke. Now, Duke can run the football. They're pretty good offense. But, again, what you have to do is you have to go back and you look at Duke's performance, say, against a bad defense in North Carolina. Starting running back Sean Wilson against North Carolina, 18 carries for 56 yards, 3.11 yards per play, per carry. Against Miami, 7 yards per carry, 9 for 63. North Carolina's got a bad defense, folks. I've been covering that team all year for another assignment. Their defense is bad. Backup running back against North Carolina. 10 carries for 90 yards, 9 yards per carry. Against Miami, 10 carries for 48, 4.8 yards per carry. So basically flip those between the two. Miami's defense had roughly the same success stopping Duke's running backs as North Carolina's defense did. And then the other thing. When I watched the Duke game, when I watched Miami against Duke, Miami secondary really struggled. Duke's receivers aren't that good. And Miami secondary is, they play, Miami plays a bunch of press man. More on that later. Miami secondary, they struggled in a number of cases. And Duke had them beat over the top a number of times. And frankly, Daniel Jones, who's not had a really good start to the year for Duke, not quite as good as last year, Daniel Jones just straight up missed him. Underthrew or overthrew on a number of occasions. And one throw that we know that Blackman makes pretty well is that vertical stuff. Bucket throws that require some touch, getting the ball down the field. They don't require a whole lot of reads. That stuff, he's doing pretty well already. There's not a whole lot of difference between dropping back and just chucking it deep in a one-on-one in high school versus in college. It doesn't take much to do that. So that's what we're going to see, by the way. This gets back to Florida State matches up better against Miami and their defense than they do against, say, Wake's defense, particularly with a young quarterback. You get a quarterback that you're trying to protect, as we talked about on the Wake analysis, post-game analysis. Florida State tried to protect Blackman. We're not throwing over the middle of the field. We're not throwing, you know, this is what they said. We're not throwing over the middle of the field. We're not going to have him reading the zone stuff that Wake does. They're not going to try to single cover us a bunch, so we're just going to run the football and get out of here. That's what they did. Miami is going to take a different approach. They're not going to try to sit back and play a bunch of zone and keep everything in front of them. They're going to challenge Florida State. You are who you are defensively. And if Miami does try to do that zone stuff, they're not going to do it as well as Wake Forest, who that's what they practice every day. Miami's going to get up in your face, and they're going to challenge you. And their corners aren't that good. Their secondary's not great. They're going to do that, and that simplifies things for a guy like Blackman. And then that allows receivers like a Keith Gavin or an Auden Tate, who's still not healthy, but he'll be out there, or a Noonie Murray if he decides he wants to actually play hard, do his job, those things. Those guys will get opportunities to win one-on-ones against Miami. It also opens up the tight end a little bit because, again, you're looking at more one-on-one stuff. It's simpler. You're not having to read the middle of the field, read zones in the same way. They'll play some zone, which again, that'll mean throw to the outside, chuck it in one-on-one, whatever one-on-one's result. But that simplifies things for Blackman. And Duke had about six opportunities for really big plays, really long plays that a couple of them should have been scores, and they missed them. They missed all but, I think, one. And that wasn't the best throw, but Jones stuck it in there, got about 30 yards on it. Those things are going to be there. They were there against Duke. Duke missed him. Florida State's probably going to miss some too with the freshman quarterback. But they'll probably hit some too because their receivers are better than Duke's. Quarterback throws some of those things better than he does other things. So you combine that, Florida State's going to be able to run the football better than people expect. They're going to stop the run pretty well. And then they're going to basically be able to get some shot plays against Miami's type of defense. That's why I look at this and I go, Florida State should be favored. This is why at the beginning of the week, I tweeted, yeah, wow. You know, people were surprised that Florida State opened as a favorite. And, you know, obviously that didn't last very long, but I tweeted out, oh, yeah, the public money's going to come in hard on Miami, but the Sharps will still be on Florida State. Because the Sharps will have seen dispassionately the same sorts of things that I've seen, which is the matchup still favors Florida State. Now, the thing is, with a true freshman quarterback, non-early enrollee, and all this other stuff that's gone on with Florida State, no game is guaranteed at this point. I mean, yeah, you're gonna beat Syracuse, say. No game, you can lose any game against a quality team, and Miami's a quality team. So I'm not saying it's a guaranteed win for Florida State. But what I am saying is Florida State should be favored and should win the game. You play this game 10 times, Florida State probably wins 7. And that's, again, because the matchups across the board around the quarterback favor Florida State. And, again, Rozier hasn't impressed me as a thrower. couple of the throws that he started out red hot against Duke, and a lot of the throws that he made against Duke aren't going to be there against Florida State's secondary. Unlikely to be there. Now, the concern for Florida State is going to be that Miami does have quality receivers. Amon Richards is really good. He's back, played against Duke. And then, you know, they've got a couple of really, really good, really fast, quick jitterbug type slots. The freshmen, Mike Harley, Jeff Thomas, and they're going to try to probably get those guys. They're probably going to try to get those guys some the ball in space and do some of what Wake Forest did offensively to give the secondary some trouble with that kind of jitterbug elite speed. Florida State's going to have to come in and make sure that they handle that well. Again, Kyle Myers in the slot will be probably a key there. But again, I think that this matchup, Miami's going to try to come in and run the football. I don't think they're going to have a whole lot of success with that. Walton is not going to find a lot of running room against Florida State's defense. And then they're going to try to set up and throw some RPO stuff. And if you can't run the football, that stuff is less dangerous. And then they're going to try to run the quarterback some, and that's one thing Florida State's going to have to worry about. The other thing is, you know, can they prevent a few big plays here and there? That's what killed them against NC State. A couple situational big plays turned that game, changed the game, along with some serious help from other quarters. So, yeah. I at the beginning of the week, I wasn't sure I was going to pick Florida State in this game, but I wanted to double check and go back and look at what Miami had actually done. Look, you know, reevaluate again what actually happened against Duke. Did they look as good as the score? Has Florida State looked as bad as some of the scores? What's the deal? And I came to this conclusion. So it's going to be interesting. I don't know that there's a whole lot more to say on this matchup. You know, I think it's critical that Kelly is going to play at left tackle. Not sure exactly how healthy he's going to be. Again, I think that was more of a muscle pull or a strain. It's imperative that Florida State be able to keep their starting offensive line on the field. The tight ends need to block better. If they do that, then I think they win this game. I'll say that, again, Florida State has about a 70%, 75% chance of winning this game. They win most likely by, say, a touchdown or so, somewhere around a score. If I'm forecasting this game, I'll say something like 24-17 Florida State. I don't think there's going to be a lot of points scored. Both defenses are good. I think both teams are going to try to run the football. Florida State's going to try to run the football a bunch. It's going to shorten the game some. So I'll say 24-17 Florida State. Most likely, again, I think Florida State wins 75% or so of this game of the times that this game is played. Being at home doesn't hurt either, although, again, the crowd's probably not going to be very good. So that said, yeah, that's my conclusion. Now, I do have one other question I've been putting off from social media for a little while. And this is from Scott Spear, 1972. Jason, could you explain how much time a college football quarterback should have to get the ball out? When I tell people 2 to 2.5 seconds and more than 2.5 is asking for trouble, they think I'm crazy. Well, that's a great question. And it actually varies depending on the drop. So the types of drops that you're taking determine how long the ball should take to get out. So couple things. One is, when we're talking about drops, we're talking about drops from under center. That's how they're discussed. And when you then adjust to shotgun, then all you do is you cut two steps off the drop. So a three-step drop from under center is a one-step drop from shotgun. It takes the same amount of time. The ball's supposed to get out at about the same time on a one-step drop from shotgun, three-step drop from under center. So when I'm talking about drops, those are what I'm talking about. So aside from like one step, you know, fade routes and things on the goal line, generally speaking, quarterback drops are divided into three step, five step, and seven step drops. And again, from shotgun, that's one step, three step, and five step. So for the three-step drop, the expectation is that the ball gets out in under 1.5 seconds. It has to be out in under 1.5 seconds. If you hold the ball more than 1.5 seconds on a three-step drop, then you expect to get, first of all, you expect to get hit and you may get sacked because the protection is only designed to hold up for 1.5 seconds. So if a quarterback gets hit at the two-second mark on a three-step drop, then that's on the quarterback. On a five-step drop, and you have a couple different variations, by the way, of a five-step drop. You have a quick five where there's no hitch. You have a five-step with a hitch, so things can differ a little bit there. But with a five-step drop, generally speaking, you're going to get routes that are closer to, you know, 12 yards or so. Some of the routes, aside from nine routes and go routes, you know, your some of your deeper stuff, that stuff's going to be 25 to 35 yards. But a lot of the routes on a five-step are going to be, you know, anywhere from your six-step bench route, which is a 12-yard out for 10 to 12-yard out for a receiver, or, you know, some digs at 12 yards or so. That's about the sort of thing you're throwing on a five-step drop. For a five-step drop, the ball needs to be out in about 2.5 seconds. Five-step drop, you expect the ball to be out in about 2.5 seconds or less. It needs to be less, ideally. More than that, and you're asking to get hit on a five-step drop. And actually, ESPN had an article on this a while back where ESPN Stats and Information, this was looking at sacks, Dwight Freeney's sacks from 2009 and 2010, said that 2.5 seconds was the average time from snap to Freeney making contact with the quarterback, which is exactly why a five-step drop, the expectation is for the quarterback to get rid of it in under 2.5 seconds. And there's actually an interesting article on this, and I think this is one of the factors, by the way, for why people get so frustrated with offensive line play, on how unrealistic football video games are in terms of the offensive line play. And basically, it draws the comparison to realistic hitting in baseball video games and realistic line play in football video games. And it's saying that realistic line play in terms of football video games would be unplayable for 95% of gamers, if not more. And basically it says, listen, here's how this article ends. It says, could gamers handle having only 1 to 3 seconds to make their reads and get the ball out before getting crushed by a realistic pass rush? I believe 95% of gamers would be begging for a patch within a week of the game's release to fix the game's broken pass protection. And then it continues. It says, attempting to play as a video game equivalent of great 4-3 defenses like the Lions, Giants, this is a while back, is an exercise in frustration. Defensive ends do not get upfield, defensive tackles do not push the pocket back, and neither position seems to explode off the ball with the sub-5-second 40-yard dash speed that today's NFL defensive linemen display. In Madden and NCAA football, defensive linemen get sucked into vacuum blocks, fail to use line moves properly, and don't use the sprint button when pursuing the quarterback, core issues that have gone unfixed in EA's football games for years. This tells you how long ago this was. All-Pro Football 2K8, feared defensive lineman like Reggie White can be easily handled by a generic offensive line that is set to quote-unquote pass block. Why are video game developers keeping the four-man pass rush from being the game-changing entity it can be in real life? To put it simply, because the people buying football games are not NFL quarterbacks. And that actually comes into the perception of how long quarterbacks should have to throw. When you're used to playing a video game and you're used to, you know, dropping back and being able to survey the field, when you see quarterbacks getting hit within 3 seconds every time, you go, well, geez, the offensive line's terrible. No. If the quarterback's held on to it longer than 2.5 seconds on a five-step drop, he's expected to get hit. That's how football works when it's played with real bodies. So, you know, you hold it 3 seconds and you're gonna get hit, generally speaking, on a five-step drop. Now, a five-step rhythm throw or a quick five, you're gonna get rid of it a little quicker. Might be out in 2 seconds flat. It's not much longer than a three-step drop. For a five-second with a hitch, or for a five-step drop with a hitch, ball needs to be out in under 2.7, really, because you're gonna step up a little bit from that pressure from the outside. You're gonna get, you know, 2.5 to 2.7 is probably right to get to your second read. Now, that, by the way, tells you how fast quarterbacks have to read the field. Ball has to be gone in 2.5 seconds. That means you need to read it that quickly, and you need to get to your second or third read in 2.5 seconds. Then you have the seven-step drop, and these are the deep drops that often play action type stuff, where you're going to get designed routes that are 20 plus yards down the field, and then you're going to, basically the quarterback here, you're going to take five long steps, five full strides getting back there, and then two more steps to stop. That's going to take the longest to develop. You're going to get more max protect stuff. Florida State's done more of this stuff with Blackmon because he's more comfortable throwing down the field, and it simplifies certain things. He can see the field a little bit longer and you know, just throw that deep post or whatever. For that kind of drop, the ball needs to be out in about three and a half seconds. It's going to take the longest to develop, but it still needs to be out before 3.5 seconds. So, yeah, you go, and if you hold it as far as 3.5 seconds, you're probably going to get hit. 3 seconds, probably best. Your quarterbacks, your best quarterbacks in the league get rid of the football really quickly. And actually, the average time to attempt in the NFL, just for what it's worth, where they take a little bit deeper drops reasonably frequently, and the average drop is more or less a five-step drop in the NFL. The average time to attempt in the NFL is 2.5 seconds. And for some of the top quarterbacks, that gets even lower. Pro Football Focus, for example, back in 2014, did an analysis of time to throw, where they graded quarterbacks and looked at how long it took each respective quarterback to do it. It's interesting. Peyton Manning threw 29 touchdowns that year in 2 seconds or less. So 2.0 seconds or less. 29 touchdowns. That's how quickly that guy got rid of the football. And that's why one of the reasons he never got hit, or rarely got hit, is because his offensive lines didn't have to protect very long. Tom Brady, his sweet spot was 2.1 to 2.5, which again goes to the types of drops that each team preferred, or each quarterback throws. So that's what you expect. And if a quarterback holds it, I think a general rule of thumb, especially for a college offensive line, even a very good college offensive line, is if you see a quarterback hold the football longer than 3 seconds, he's going to get hit. And generally speaking, unless it's a deep drop type, seven-step type thing, or five-step, you know, play action out of, say, pistol or something like that in the shotgun, then if a guy holds it longer than 3 seconds, the quarterback did something wrong. Now, for some of those deep drops, 3.5 seconds. Give him an extra half a second for the extra deep drops. But that's the reality. So hopefully that helps. Hopefully that explains a little bit. And it also gets to when you're evaluating, is it the offensive line's fault that the quarterback got hit? First of all, you have to look at where the guy came from. Did the guy come from, you know, the tight end who missed a block, or the running back who is responsible for a blitz? Or is it, you know, like with the Alabama situation where Francois got hurt? Is it a guy that the quarterback's going to be responsible for, given the way that the offensive line has to slide against a given front? These sorts of things. Some of that stuff's harder to know. But one thing you can know is how long did the quarterback hold onto the ball? Look at the clock. If it's a shorter drop and the quarterback holds onto it longer than 2 seconds, then, well, it's probably on the quarterback to get hurt, or that he got hit. If it's a longer drop and it's you see the clock go over 3 seconds, you're pushing it, and probably quarterback's fault as much as anybody that he got hit. Okay, well, once again, that's going to do it for us. I think, like I said, Florida State should be favored in this game. They're not, because the public has been deceived by and large by strength of schedule. And few people more deceived than a lot of the negative Florida State fans out there It's going to be interesting to see how this game transpires. I mean, like I said, everything is a little bit more unpredictable just because of the nature of the makeup of the team with a true freshman quarterback. But it's going to be an interesting weekend. Try to enjoy it, everybody. Enjoy the progress of a young team. This has been the Unconquered Podcast on Seminole Sports Radio, brought to you by Luis Marquez of Keller Williams Realty in Jacksonville, Florida. If you've enjoyed this podcast, if you've enjoyed prior episodes, please make sure to go and rate us rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts. It helps a lot. On iTunes, helps a lot. Rate us on Stitcher. Rate it wherever you consume this podcast. And please be sure to subscribe and share this podcast with anybody else that you know that enjoys Florida State sports or wants to know more about how some of the details of football work. Once again, this has been the Unconquered Podcast on Seminole Sports Radio. I'm your host, Jason Staples. Thanks for listening. I made this.